in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, forced starvation and genocide in Gaza as Palestinians continue to die of hunger in the streets of their ancient city, searching through the rubble for food and gunned down randomly in the process. And remembering celebrated social visionary activist and Rilke translator Joanna Macy as she has moved into the spirit world. Macy's longtime friend and co-translator Anita Barrows joins us for the hour. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Just a few headlines from the genocide. At least 49 more Palestinians have been killed in recent hours in Israeli attacks across Gaza. Medical sources say as the Israeli military has sent tanks into areas of Derbala in central Gaza for the first time since Israel began its assault and besieged the territory. Joining us to talk about that, and she's covering it through poetry, is our good friend Anita Barrows, who has been writing a poem every day of this genocide. And the poetry is powerful, and it will help us remember, after all this is over, what happened and who did what to who. Anita, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, these are terrible times, particularly for the people living in occupied Palestine. The slaughter, the targeting of two-year-olds, the starvation and the use of starvation as a weapon of war and genocide is just extraordinary. So also, we have a great loss. Your friend, the crucial visionary, and we are glad to have you help us remember Joanna Macy, who passed on to the spirit world. Let's start with Gaza, and we'll end with remembering Joanna Macy. But I want to give the microphone to you. You came into the studio, Anita. You've been keeping track of a poem every day. Remind listeners what you've been doing, and then take some time to read us some poetry.
Thank you. Yeah, I will do that. At the beginning of the genocide, I thought, you know, what can I do? How can I express what I am feeling, and how can I bear witness, and what capacity do I have to do anything about this? And, you know, I've been writing poetry forever, since I was a child. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to sit down and write poems. It was interesting. I spent some time this afternoon listening to some interviews that were done with Joanna Macy. The most recent one I heard was done in 2019, and she was speaking about poetry being about the use of poetry that had become increasingly common in the workshops that she taught. And she said specifically in this interview she did with Krista Tippett that it felt very important to her because poetry got to a different place. It was, you know, whatever the poem was about, the facts were there, the truths were there, but the rhythms and the sounds of the poem reached a different place in the hearer. And I thought, that's exactly why I started writing these poems, and why I keep doing it. It is a way of reporting, as I know you've said, but it's a way of reporting that reaches, you know, we could say right brain, we could say gut, we could say it's visceral. So I'll read day 653. That was yesterday. This was Dr. Abu Safia. It's for him. He was a pediatrician, the head of a hospital. He had a son who was murdered, another son who spoke for him, more in his family. He buried his son on the hospital grounds, still wearing his scrubs, so he could go back immediately to see his patients. This was the man they captured. This was the man they beat. This was the man who walked with strength and dignity to the tank that awaited him. This was the man they took to the prison, the man they tortured, the man they continued to torture. He has lost 80 pounds, the weight of some of the children he treated. He who strode, holding his head upright, to the tank that took him. He can barely walk now, so severely they've beaten him, starved him, kept him from going outside, kept him in an underground cell in the dark. He was a doctor. His work was the healing of children. Has the world abandoned him? Will he wither in his cell? Until he is nothing, until his name in some brief article online is all that remains of him. It's tragic. I mean, the things that are happening are unbelievably tragic. This is the one I wrote a few hours ago today. You were mentioning the starvation. This is one of my many poems about the children who are starving. This one is about a baby who lived 5 weeks and starved to death. Day 654. This infant lived 35 days, 5 weeks. Born in June, he lived until mid-July. What he knew of this world was early light, late twilight, evening stars, a single cycle of the moon, the start of another. What he knew of this world was hunger, his mother's fear, familiar to him from what coursed through his body as he grew in her womb, familiar to him through her arms as she held him, through her dry breasts as she tried to feed him. What he knew of this world was the sound of drones, explosions, screams. What he knew was smoke, the stench of death, raw sewage mixed with the smell carried by sea winds, mixed with improbable sweetness, fragrance of jasmine. What he knew were voices telling him love, strength. Voices describing to him his eyes, his ears, his mouth like his father's, hands like his aunt's. What he knew was his body's agony as his empty stomach groaned and knotted. What he knew was that one day his cry disappeared when he opened his mouth. The movement of his small legs, too, disappeared. Then the grasp of his fingers.
This really is a war against children, isn't it?
It is. It is exactly that. It is a war against children. It's unbearable. Unbearable that the children are being targeted. And we know this. I mean, we know this because we have seen the children who have been shot deliberately in the head, children who've been shot deliberately in the chest. There's no question but that this is a war against children. And the Israelis are open about it. They don't want there to be another generation of Palestinians. It's just tragic. I'll read another one. This is day 652. The house is destroyed. Those who lived in it are buried under collapsed walls. Rescue workers have given up on finding anyone alive. There were four, a father, a mother, a girl of 16, and her year-old sister. 4 days since the bombing. The dust has settled. The house is in ruins. Suddenly, the 16-year-old girl walks out of the rubble, eyes bleeding, face bruised, injuries to her head. She doesn't realize she's alive. She doesn't know everyone else has been killed. Where is her tiny sister, her mother? She walks, as though in a sleep, to her aunt's house next door, finds it empty. Finds some water to wash her face. Is she living? Is everyone else dead? She wanders, stumbling, staggering. At last, someone recognizes her, takes her to her uncle. He holds her hand, speaks to her gently. She's speechless, numb, a ghost, not certain how she survived, not certain if she survived. This is day 651. I realize these are all about children, all the poems that I have written recently about children, because that's the most agonizing news. Day 651. This baby was found trapped under the rubble. No one else in her household survived. The young woman they found dead, could she have been her mother? One of the men found dead, her father? Were there grandparents, uncles? Did she have sisters, brothers? The children's bodies so shattered, it was hard to tell who these legs belonged to, these hands. But this baby, 6 months old, seven, she was whole, uninjured, hungry and terrified, but intact. She cried. She looked up into the arms of the medical rescuer. Where will he take her now? No name, no certain age, no address. Someone will care for her, but who? What story will she never tell?
Could you talk a little bit about, I mean, your work as a child psychotherapist has you eye to eye with children every day, almost every day of the week, and you understand as good as anybody can in this world, the devastating nature that this kind of impact has on children. Could you talk a little bit about how will these kids, even if they survive, they're not, they may be survivors, but they don't survive as holistic human beings because they're being so shredded, subjected to such inhumane viciousness that it's, I don't want them to die. I want as many people as can be saved to be saved. But what happens in a child's life who manages to keep breathing?
Right, exactly. I think about that all the time. The children that I have worked with who are traumatized are lucky to have parents who bring them to therapy, whether it's paid for by the state or whether the parents can afford it. What you say to the people surrounding a traumatized child is keep things as stable as possible. Keep the child's routine going as well as you possibly can. Be as faithful as you can to keeping the child going to school every day, informing the teachers that this child has undergone a trauma. All of this, and there's so much more that you say to the people around a traumatized child, that all has to do with community and security and predictability. All of that can't happen for these children in Gaza. Nothing is secure. Nothing is predictable. When are they going to eat the next meal? When was the last meal? And so these children, I've heard reports from people who are there, people who have been there. Abu Bakr Ahmed, Abed, who now is living in Ireland but was living in Deir al-Balah, spoke very movingly on one Electronic Intifada segment some months ago about children that he had been talking to who couldn't talk. Children of 8, 9, 10 years old who he knew from before the genocide, who were able to talk as well as any child, who had lost the ability to speak, who had become mute, or who were so ravaged emotionally by the constant bombing, the constant drones, the loss of their family, the hunger, the fear, that they couldn't string a coherent sentence together. And when I think about what it's going to take to help these children adjust in whatever way they can once this is over, it's unfathomable. It's unfathomable, the things that they have experienced and seen. And so a whole generation, and we have to remember also that this generation of children, the ones who are now teenagers, have been through several wars, several sets of bombing, several moments of destruction that have happened just relentlessly on the part of the Israelis. This is the worst and this is the longest for sure. But these children are going to have such a long road ahead of them if they're going to recover.
And what happens to the witnesses? What happens to the people, the kids in this country, who watch this unfolding, who watch the adults here not doing anything about it, shipping over more bombs? What does any, really, it's sort of many different kinds of survivors here. Can we remain human in the face of this kind of dropping 2,000-pound bombs on infants? What kind of survivors are we?
Absolutely. It is unbearable. And I know there are children, my grandson among them, who's 9 years old, Dashiell, who is, Dashiell is very aware of what's going on. He talks about it with his mother and father all the time. And he's aware of how tragic it is. I know that there are other children who are very aware of it. And then there are the children who are not being told about it, but who see the images maybe, you know, now and then on television. And the children who think that this is the way to do things, that this is how people win a war. I mean, I don't even know how to express it. We need to really worry about those children. I think the ones who see it and the ones who can be spoken to by their parents or their teachers or their mentors or whoever and helped to see it with compassionate eyes and help to think about what they can do to make a difference, those children will be more okay than the ones who are taught that this is the way things are done. And this country is really morally lost.
You know, I have to monitor the corporate news every day to see what they're saying and what they're not saying. And I just monitored 2 hours on one of these networks without a mention of this. They're talking about, what's his name, Jeffrey whatever.
Oh, God.
For hours. But dropping bombs on infants somehow doesn't make the front page. It makes the front page here at KPFA at Flashpoints. You're listening to Anita Barrows. We have her today. She's been writing a poem every day of this genocide, documenting what many just don't want to see or hear about. Please, Anita, read a few more for us.
Thank you. Day 649. The child was born healthy 3 years ago, chubby baby nursed by her mother. Her mother, too, healthy, strong, vibrant. Now they live in a makeshift tent whose sides have been battered by rain, unrelenting heat. Now her mother has lost 4 older children. Now her father has been gone for a year, missing somewhere under the rubble. Now the child weighs what she weighed at 13 months, her legs so thin and weak she can barely walk. Her mother picks her up when she cries at night and is stunned each time by her lightness, her near inexistence. It seems, as the days go by without food or respite, that her child is becoming a petal, the wing of a moth, a scrap of paper blown by the wind. Day 645. They lie dead next to each other on the linoleum floor of the clinic, a boy and a girl, maybe 2 years old, 3. Were they twins, siblings, cousins? Did they know one another at all? Someone that morning dressed the boy in jeans, a green t-shirt, the girl in white lacy panties, a flowered dress. Someone tied her pink shoes. Someone helped the boy with the metal button of his jeans, all stained with blood now, drying blood. Were they playing together when the bomb struck? Near them, a woman bends over the body of an older boy, lying still, his eyes half open. Is he alive? Is she pleading desperately for someone to save him? Is she the mother of all 3 of them, and the boy sitting a little apart, his body seemingly whole, a blank, startled look on his dirt-splattered face? I have to say, all of my poems come from something that I have read or seen. That was a photograph in, I believe it was either Al Jazeera English or Mondo Weiss. But all of this is truth. All of this is reporting. All of this is what's happening. Day 644. The school they were sheltering in has gone up in flames. Tell me, who could escape it? Not the pregnant mother with her toddler son. Not the father who'd already buried his wife and five children, every loss slowing his steps. Not the elderly poet, the builder whose legs had been rendered useless, the friends who wrapped their arms tenderly around each other's waists and waited, waited, lay waiting together as flames raced toward them. Who could escape the roar, the pulsing, the screams, the horrified eyes? School that had held children singing, now a ruined cradle, crucible, urn. This is day 640, and it's dedicated to a Gazan poet named Manal Mikdad. She's a poet, she's a mother. As far as I know, she is still living. And I saw her poems in a book of poems written in Arabic, translated into Spanish, which I can read. And at the beginning of one of her poems, she wrote this. It was in italics. So these are Manal Mikdad's words. Opposed to my friends who have books I loaned you, if I should die, keep them. They're yours. Opposed to my cousin, if nothing happens to my library, it's yours. Manal Mikdad was very concerned about her books, and I remember when Rifat al-Arir was still alive for a couple of months at the beginning of the genocide, he was very concerned that his library had been destroyed before he was assassinated. So this is from Manal Mikdad. Poet, mother of three, you ask yourself in your journal why, with bombs falling not far from you, you're thinking about your books. All the books you lost in that last siege, then replaced. All the books you've loved, learned from, read passages from your friends to, your children. How you ask yourself, will you carry yourself? How will you carry these books when you flee? How many will you be able to hold? How much will they slow you down? Will your children carry some of them? They'll be carrying their own things. Why are you thinking so desperately about your books? Why books? All this you're asking yourself as bombs fall on your city. You remember hours reading, studying, how they shaped your life, these books. The past, you write, once upon a time. The past is now a cemetery. You know, I think there's such horrible propaganda, so many horrible lies about the people of Gaza. A lot of people in this country have no idea what a hugely educated people they are. I read a statistic a few months ago, which I hadn't known about. The largest proportion of people with PhDs per population is in Gaza. There are extraordinary, or have been until this genocide, extraordinary surgeons and scientists and scholars and poets and professors. And all of this is what is being destroyed. This is day 637. Here is the place where we played ball. Here was a field, a street. Here there were houses. There you can see the remains of a school. Here was the time when we walked out the door and found our friends waiting. Here were the bright afternoons, hot in summer, crisp in autumn, when we learned to kick hard, to run fast, punt with our heads. Here we shouted to each other when someone scored. Here we taught one another how to play better. Here we were happy. So we take this ball, kick it into the fetid air, the smoke, the dust. Someone kicks it back beyond us. Those piles of rubble to the left, the right can be our goals. We will play despite everything. When, why would we ever stop playing?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are spending the hour with Anita Barros. Later on, we're going to be remembering her friend, Joanna Macy, who has passed on to the spirit world. But it was really important to me and to us that we mark, as the world turns a blind eye, that we mark that there is a genocide going on. The people of the United States of America are sustaining it, are paying for it, are watching as our government ships over these massive weapons to drop on two-year-olds and one-year-olds. It's pretty extraordinary. You talk about evolution, right? And we've come a long way, or maybe we haven't come anywhere. I don't even know where we are now, given the fact that we have the ability to turn a blind eye and go on and enjoy our lives as if this isn't happening, as if the United States isn't funding it. It's not just ignorance, because many know. There are pictures. It is available. It's sort of what's left of our consciousness and our humanity.
Exactly. What's left of any moral compass in this country. I heard today that some, I believe it was 30 countries, including France and Britain, that was a surprise, had some vote in which they urged Israel desperately to stop the genocide and to allow real food, real humanitarian aid into Gaza at this point, stop the starvation. And the United States and Germany did not sign on. And that we live in a country that will not sign on to allowing baby formula in. There is no baby formula left in Gaza. That's why these infants are dying at 5 weeks old.
I mean, people are essentially, they're drinking the ocean and eating sand.
Right.
That's what's going on here.
Right.
As the whole world watches. And this, just the whole concept that they've created of this so-called food distribution, essentially it's like putting a piece of cheese, like a rat's trap, putting a piece of cheese under a glass, and when you reach for it, you get shot.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They lure people. The people are desperate. They're starving. Their children are starving. They're watching their children disappear before their eyes. And what parent wouldn't do anything they could to get a scrap of food for their child? And they go to get their scraps of food, and they're killed. My wonderful student in Gaza, I have three young people whose writing I've been mentoring. My wonderful student, Taqwa, who read one of her poems for a little while some months ago on Flashpoints, she said that although her family is starving now, they're all hungry. She has younger siblings who are starving. They are so afraid to go to the distribution centers that they don't go. And so there's the choice they have. They starve at home, or they risk getting killed at the distribution point. And she today, albeit starving, wrote to me because I posted to all my friends in the world, including her. She wrote the most beautiful condolence note about Joanna Macy. And I thought, my God, this kid who is living in the midst of a genocide writes a beautiful, loving, compassionate note. Shall I read another poem?
Please.
Okay.
Please. I'm letting, it's up to you.
Yeah, and at some point we'll pivot to talking about Joanna, because I have a lot of the Rilke poems.
Let's do a few more here, and let's remind people that all this is available. Your daughter, Nora Barros Friedman, of the Electronic Intifada, has helped you get this onto the web, and so there's a website, right?
Yes, she's created a really beautiful website for the poems. It's the link is poemsforgaza.com, all one word, poems for
That's
Gaza.
Easy.
Okay, so this is day 634, and this is dedicated to my student Ahmed in Gaza. He is in Khan Yunis, which has undergone heavy bombing. Your streets are nothing but dust and echoes. Those were his words in something he wrote and sent me. Your streets are nothing but dust and echoes. A belt of fire circles the tents. You write, flames raging around you. What else to do? Nowhere you can go, nowhere to escape this. In her womb, your wife, age 24, carries your child. The first child died under the rubble. Now this one grows protected, if anything can be protected, from mercilessness, brutality. You tell me the simple foods you want to eat. Chicken, bread, rice. How could it seem so impossible to dream of eating such simple foods? In a tree stripped of summer leaves by the bombings, one bird is singing. He sits on a naked branch, his small throat pulsing with song. See, we resist, he reports to the sky, clear for a moment of smoke and flames.
Let's do one more, and then we'll take a break, and we'll begin to remember Joanna, who obviously cared a great deal about this.
Great. This is day 631. This was from a photograph that was in Al Jazeera. Outside the hospital, a man and a woman are tenderly holding the body of an infant who died from malnutrition. Had they been taking her to the hospital for treatment, walked there from wherever they'd been, and arrived too late? The infant is wrapped in a white shroud, maybe a sheet or a pillowcase. You can see in the photograph the top of her head, perfectly formed, a few strands of hair. She is weeks old at the most. The man and the woman, are they her parents? Her grandparents? The man has some gray in his hair. The woman's face is weary. Weary from grief, starvation, 20 months of brutality, and before that, years. They hold the infant with such tenderness. Their love and their mourning are in their fingers. Both are weeping now. The infant's life is dissolving into poisoned air, into toxic water, dissolving as they walked, ran, carrying her. Now she belongs to the earth. Now she is only a name and a memory. Their hands learning her by heart so as not to forget.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are reading poems. We're hearing poetry by Anita Barros, who is a wonderful poet, 15 or 16 books, much experience with children. And so these poems reflect your experience, Anita. And obviously, we appreciate that you've helped us keep make sure we keep a human face on this slaughter. People in this country don't really seem to care. And that terrifies me almost as much as the killing of innocents.
Yes.
But we're not going to take our spotlight off this because we don't want people to forget. And I am so appreciative that you and Nora have put a marker in the sand, getting this up on the web. It'll be there, and maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years, people will realize, oh my God, what happened. What I'd like to do is take a musical break, give everybody a chance to breathe, and then let's come back and remember your friend, all of our friend, Joanna Mason. So we'll be back in a moment. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Anita Barrows. Anita Barrows is a poet, a psychotherapist, and a friend to Joanna Macy. It's hard to put her in the past. Could you tell people who don't know much about Joanna Macy who she has been in this universe, what she has brought to all of us? You translated Rilke with her. I know you have a few of those poems. Talk to us about Joanna Macy.
Yes, sir. Well, Joanna was. It is very hard to talk about her in the past. I think she's listening to us. Joanna was absolutely not afraid of the suffering of the world. She faced it head on. And that was the core of the work she did. She was brilliant. She was a scholar. She had a PhD in religious studies, Buddhist studies. She wrote a wonderful book about a particular aspect of Buddhist theory that stemmed from her dissertation. She began when she was in her 50s. I should say Joanna died Saturday at the age of 96. But in her 50s, she began doing a kind of work which was really informed by her sense that what we needed to develop was both insight about what was going on in the world and compassion for people who were suffering, for the ecosystem that was suffering, for all living beings. That stems very much from Buddhist theory, but really is the core of any spirituality. And so Joanna began doing these workshops. Originally, they were called Despair and Empowerment, where people were able to get in touch experientially with their sense of despair for the world. And then the next step was, okay, what are we going to do about it? And to empower ourselves from the depths of that grief and pain to take action, because Joanna was an activist. She later began calling her work the work that reconnects, and what it reconnects us to is exactly what you and I have been talking about, Dennis, about the ways in which people are so disconnected from what's happening in Gaza, from you know, the ways in which the mainstream media handles it, and the deliberate ignorance that is sort of pervade upon the American public and other people in the West. Joanna really wanted to counter that and help people get in touch with their deepest heart that could look without fear at the world. And I thought I would read a couple of paragraphs. We translated 4 books together of the work of Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet. And the first one we did, we started working on together in 1993 in German, Das Stundenbuch, the Book of Hours. Our book was called Rilke's Book of Hours, and we each wrote a preface to the book. We wrote an introduction together that was more academic, more about Rilke and his biography and theory of our translation. But Joanna and I each wrote a personal preface, and I'll read these paragraphs from Joanna's preface because they really connect this work to what we've just been talking about regarding Gaza. So Joanna is talking about her work that reconnects. The work I offered helps people overcome denial about the condition of our world. I'm going to read that sentence again. Joanna often would read a line of poetry twice or even 3 times. So I'm going to channel Joanna. The work I offered helps people overcome denial about the condition of our world. By understanding and embracing their despair, they come to their senses again and transform the despair into strong connective energy. That your world is in agony is no reason to turn your back on it, or to try to escape into private spiritual pursuits. Rilke reminded me that I had the strength and courage to walk out into the world as into my own heart, and to love the things, this is a quotation from our translations, to love the things as no one has thought to love them. My own stubborn, wild love for the world, Joanna continues, was summoned, and I learned to recognize it in others, too, in workshops and strategy sessions of the peace and environmental movements. Rilke confirmed my sense of a deep passion at the core of life itself, which I could come home to. So this was 1993, and that spirit deeply informed all of Joanna's work. She was deeply concerned about the people of Gaza. She was very encouraging to me when I went to Palestine. I went for 5 summers to the West Bank to work with a counseling center, and Joanna was one of my greatest cheerleaders for that work at the time. It was in the early 2000s. She was, you know, very concerned about climate change. She was very concerned about all of the issues and concerned up until the last days she could speak. So I'm going to read a few of the poems from our translations. The first few I'll read are from the Book of Hours, and this first one was kind of Joanna's, what do they call it? Kind of a Hallmark poem, not Hallmark cards, but this was Joanna's sort of motto. Ich lebe mein Leben in wachsenden Ringen. I live my life in widening circles. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. I circle around God, around the primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song?
Read that last line again.
Yes. I'll read the whole last stanza.
Thank you.
I circle around God, around the primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? I was asked to recite this yesterday at a small gathering for Joanna, and I didn't have the book with me. I could recite it from memory, and as I was saying the poem, which I could not say without tears, as I was saying it, I thought, I know the answer to that. Joanna was a great song. I have to say a little bit about our process of translation, because it was remarkable. I had done translations before. Before I became a psychologist, I was doing translations for publishers in England and here. I had never done a translation in collaboration with another person. And when Joanna and I started translating together, it was a whole different experience. We both knew German, and I am a poet, was a poet. Joanna was not specifically a poet, but she loved poetry. She had such a poetic sense, and the way she spoke and the way she moved people in her workshops was deeply poetic. Her poetry was just not written, it was spoken. But we did every single one of these translations in collaboration with each other. We would read the German out loud. We would sit together, and one of us would, you know, sort of throw out a possibility for the first line. And the other one would say, well, that's good, but how about? And then we would find maybe a third possibility and a fourth possibility. And then we would jump up and down and say, yes, that's exactly right. And so it was exhilarating and joyous and totally collaborative. And it was a very, I think, rare experience of two minds really working in such concert together, that we worked as one. And we would say very often when we would give readings of our poems, why would anybody bother doing a translation alone? It's so much more fun to do it together. So I'm going to read another poem from the Book of Hours. This is the poem that Joanna referred to in those paragraphs, and this was one of the first ones that we translated together. All of our titles in this book are from the German. Dich wundert nicht, der Sturm ist Wucht. You are not surprised at the force of the storm. You have seen it growing. The trees flee. Their flight sets the boulevard streaming. And you know, he whom they flee is the one you move toward. All your senses sing him as you stand at the window. The weeks stood still in summer. The tree's blood rose. Now you feel it wants to sink back into the source of everything. You thought you could trust that power when you plucked the fruit. Now it becomes a riddle again, and you again a stranger. Summer was like your house. You knew where each thing stood. Now you must go out into your heart as onto a vast plain. Now the immense loneliness begins. The days go numb. The wind sucks the world from your senses like withered leaves. Through the empty branches, the sky remains. It is what you have. Be earth now and even song. Be the ground lying under that sky. Be modest now, like a thing ripened until it is real, so that he who began it all can feel you when he reaches for you. And I want to read a few of the lines again, because those lines are engraved in my mind as they were in Joanna's. Summer was like your...
Before you do that, I have to say this in the name of humor, which she had a great sense of humor. I had a listener call me up once and said, you know, I really love this show. I listen to it every day. But why do you have to do that poetry crap? Can you just put that somewhere?
Oh boy.
What do you think Joanna would have said to that?
She would have said, sit down and listen. Joanna could be very directive. Sit down, be quiet, and listen.
And listen.
Right. Oh boy. Summer was like your house. You knew where each thing stood. Now you must go out into your heart as onto a vast plain. I really love that. I want to read a couple of poems. You know, Joanna, in her last weeks, she wanted these poems to be read to her or recited to her. She was sustained in her last weeks by these poems. They were so important to her. And
people should know that the last sense to go is hearing.
Yes, exactly.
So keep talking.
Exactly. Keep talking. All of us keep talking. It is so important. So these poems I'm going to read are from the Sonnets to Orpheus, which we translated in the early 2000s. This book was published in 2005. And this is Sonnets to Orpheus, Part 2, Number 13. This is one of my and Joanna's deep favorites. And I have to say, when I looked at my book this afternoon, I saw that I had written some extra words in my own handwriting, because Joanna and I were always working on these poems. And even after they were published, we were still working on them. And we read this poem one day, maybe 5 years after the book was published, and we thought, no, we should have written two more words into this poem, and I won't tell you what they are.
Okay. We got 2 minutes,
okay,
so please.
I'll read this. This is a magnificent poem. Be ahead of all parting, as if it had already happened, like winter, which even now is passing. For beneath the winter is a winter so endless that to survive it at all is a triumph of the heart. Be forever dead in Eurydice and climb back singing, climb praising as you return to connection. Here, among the disappearing in the realm of the transient, be a ringing glass that shatters as it rings. Be, and at the same time, know what it is not to be. That emptiness inside you allows you to vibrate in resonance with your world. Own it now and become complete. To all that has run its course, and to the vast, unsayable numbers of beings abounding in nature, add yourself gladly and cancel the cost.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to miss Joanna Macy, but we'll carry, you know, a piece of the heart with us. We thank you, Anita Barros, poet, translator, friend of this show, been keeping track of the Gaza genocide via poetry. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you, Anita, and the work that you've been doing, helping us keep it human and understand what's being done in our name. And that's it for us. Thank you, Anita.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.